Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome everybody to this very special motorsport podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
This is a very special podcast because, as you may have noticed, we have three drivers here, three guests. We usually have one guest, but we have three guests today who have seven Le Mans victories between them. That's right, isn't it? We'll get that right. Good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think
so. I know how many I've got.
So, firstly, we have Richard Atwood. Thank you very much for coming, Richard. Winner of the 1970 Le Mans 24-hour race. And we have Derek Bell, winner in 75, 81, 82, and 1986.
And 87.
And 87. And finally,
you've got to get very good, can't Derek. Just forget a win at Le Mans just like that, can you? You could lose your job for that.
And Nick Tandy, winner outright in 2015 with a spectacular drive through the night, which we'll come back to in a second. So it's a very warm welcome to you all. Thanks for coming. And I have to start by asking for your recollections on your first ever race. I'm interested to try and find some links between you three guys. So your first ever race, and I can bet they were very different vehicles, very different races, very different mindset. So who wants to start their first ever race?
All right, I started with a Lotus. Derek. I'm this end of the table. I started with a Lotus 7.
Yeah.
At Goodwood, March the 13th, 1964. One in the rain, 66.48 miles an hour. Is that enough?
That's brilliant. So, Nick,
how the hell do you know that?
But I tell you why, Nick, because I happen to have an alarm clock, which is what I won. A travelling alarm clock, no less.
You won a prize at your first race.
I did. And it's a travelling alarm clock, and on the front of
five times, yeah.
And on the front of it is engraved the BARC badge, and with those that inscription on. So I look at it every day to remind myself who I am.
So. Set the bar quite high there.
Thanks.
I need average, average speed. Everything. Go for it.
My first one was '96.
Yeah,
Hensford Hills Raceway, a Mini 850cc, and I started at the back of the grid because my mother didn't want me to start the first race at the front, and I've got no idea where I came or anything around it.
But you finished.
I couldn't tell you. I'm pretty sure I finished, yeah.
Of course you did.
Because we were so confident, then we started the second race at the front.
Yeah, good.
And I think I came fifth or so in that one, but the first one was
so bad. Jack's asking where you qualified. Jack's our online editor, by the way, everyone. I forgot to introduce you, but welcome to Jack. So, Jack, what was your question?
I think Mum's gone. But if your mum made you start at the back, where did you qualify?
Oh, it was graded order. So novices and lower, lower point scorers always start at the front, right. And then the stock car racing, the high point scorers start at the back and work their way through to the front. But if you're really If you're really scared, then you can start at the back as a novice.
Okay. Richard, then, over to you. First race.
Well, mine was also a Goodwood. It was a standard 10.
Okay.
And it was my father's car that was used during the Suez Crisis, which was 1955. So this was, I don't know if it was 58, I guess.
Okay.
There's actually a picture of the car in Autosport. I have no idea why, because I wasn't anybody. And I can't tell you where I finished, but I finished.
Yep.
But actually, before a Goodwood, before you could race there, you had to do a, I don't know about Derek, but at my time, you had to do a regularity session around the track. Yeah.
Yeah.
For about quite a long time, maybe half an hour, three quarters.
Really?
And if you went too slow, they'd ask you to come back when you've got a bit of speed on. And if you were too fast or reckless, they would chuck you out. So it was quite a serious thing.
Yeah.
And we know it's a dangerous track now, but I don't think it was sort of that way then. I've no idea why, but I do remember that. And I drove all the way down from Wolverhampton to do that.
Yeah.
No motorway, so it took me, 7 hours to get there.
in the car you raced? Or
yes,
did
in
you
a standard 10, because you're a road car.
Yeah.
It's the only car they had. Only car I had. And so I did my bit,
yeah.
And they said that was fine, and I was totally elated to think that I had done it something right for once.
Yeah.
And then I drove all the way back home. The whole trip was, I drove back on adrenaline because I was so happy to have done that, and then I went to do my first race from that.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So now I can't think of a link at all between those. First of all, I thought it would be a four-cylinder front-wheel drive front-engine car, because you had a four-cylinder front-engine. Yours four-cylinder front-engine. Standard 10.
Front-engine, four-cylinder, rear-wheel drive.
Four-cylinder, front-engine,
so four-cylinder. You all started in four-cylinders.
And both at Goodwood.
And you two at Goodwood.
But there were very few.
Let us side down.
Almost Goodwood.
Yeah. But there were very few front-engine drive cars, front-wheel drive cars at that time.
Yeah.
Minis.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yes. There you go.
Goodness me. Well, there we go.
But he had. Mm. I mean, he was in the modern era then. Mini.
He's a young man, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, it was basically classics. 96, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Mini came out in what, 57 or
59?
59.
It came out.
That's right. So yeah.
Sadly, I know all of my Mini history. Yeah. Racing them for 10 years.
10 years.
Yes.
Good God.
I think you should tell us a story then. I think if there's got to be within the 10 years, there has to be a story of. Have you each got a mini story? There we go. Have you each got a short story?
You mean?
Well, none of your stories are short.
You mean a mini story? I haven't. I have a story and a mini.
Yeah.
I have one, so I can get mine over with quickly.
Go on then.
I drove the Felday.
Not that close to you.
Sorry, I drove the Felday 1273 or even more, 1275 or 1293 Felday Engineering Mini Cooper at Alton Park. And I remember I thought I was going very well until I spun hellishly at the hairpin. You remember the hairpin around the edge of the lake? I sort of looped it off up there, and I don't know what happened. I didn't crash. I just... You spun, but you know, in those days, if you spun, you'd had it. So I don't know where I finished. But that was the only tale, really. But at least I spun, at least I drove one. And then the other one was I used to tow my Lotus 7 with one, but carry on.
There you go.
That is dangerous.
So come on, Nick. A story from the 10 years of mini racing.
Oof, mini racing. I've got plenty of mini roadcast tales that
shouldn't be aired.
You shouldn't probably, probably let my mum know about those. But I remember having to weld a floor back in one of my racing cars here at Silverstone, actually, because it failed scrutineering. They didn't seem too impressed with a rusty car being presented to to go racing. But other than crashing lots and blowing many, many A-series engines up, and spending many a night in the garage putting the bloody things back together on a Saturday night between qualifying and the race.
Were you a good mechanic then?
Or a good welder?
Be honest.
You learned, don't you?
You learned a hell of a lot.
I did a lot of work on engine work and gearbox work.
Must have helped you when you drove for Porsche the first time then, at Le Mans.
It would have helped this year, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
shall I move on swiftly? Unless Richard, you have a mini story.
I don't have a race mini ever. But I remember going to, I think it was Zolder, and we were going to go, we were driving with David Hobbs, and we wanted to have a really economic car. So my father had garages, so we borrowed a Mini.
Yeah.
And we went across on all these awful roads that were bad in those days. It was back in the early 60s. And I swore never to drive a Mini again because it's such short wheelbase. You went down every dip and up every dip. It was the worst road trip I think I've ever had. So I never drove a Mini again.
And that was worse than a standard 10, so you can see what the standard 10. You can see where his standards were.
I loved my standard 10. It was a great little car. It really was.
Right, you know, we've had some fabulous questions from our readers, so I'm actually going to dive straight in. And the first one is from Anthony Jenkins, and this is for Richard and Derek. Do your Le Mans successes feel sweeter for having to share them with only one driving partner and not two?
Well, I mean, I don't know, because we only ever had two. Maybe Derek had three, so he might be able to do the comparison. But I don't think that really makes a lot of difference, really. Because you're all doing your bit, and I think you all feel that you've done your bit well, hopefully, and so I don't think it would make any difference to me. But maybe somebody who's had four or even five co-drivers might think they might feel less part of it. But for me, I only ever had one, so I can't answer that really.
Now, obviously, I drove the first 12 years in sports cars, with just two drivers, as far as I can remember. And I know with Jackie Ickx, he wrote to me at the beginning of 83, because we had won in 81 and 82, and he wrote to me and said, I think it's time we had a third driver. And I was absolutely stunned. It hadn't crossed my dense mind that it was probably a good idea, because many, many of the other teams had three drivers. But I got so used to doing it with him. And of course, by now, the cars were getting more ground effecty. And because the 962 had been out for 2 years at this point. And so I wasn't at all keen, and he said, who should we have with us? And I wrote back and said, I've no idea. Mm. Nick Tandy's not around it. So I couldn't go for that. So, and Richard's too old. And so that was the end of the story, really. But no, seriously, there was no, I said, I got so used to sharing, I got so used to the relationship with him, which sounds weird, but we'd done four Le Mans together, and I think we'd won three of them. So, you know, we had a great close relationship, and I just couldn't see sharing with anybody else. It never crossed my mind that I might be getting tired in a race. And I just said I didn't know. And so we actually went, just the two of us, and the other team cars that Porsche had three in. And I think Jochen and Jackie, no, who was Jochen with that year? Anyway, I think he only had two. And Jackie and I were together, and then there was three in the sort of guest car, which was Early Hayward and Al Holbert and Jürgen Barth. And of course they won, and we were so knackered it really kicked us in the teeth, because we actually finished 26 seconds behind at the end, after being, you know, flat, having kept breaking something else would break. So that was the last time we drove with two drivers. Then after I drove with Al Holbert and Hans Stuck, as well. So
did it feel? Did the success or the feeling feel thinned out because you had the extra driver in there?
No, the way I did see it was that with two drivers, we had a very special relationship, and I can't explain that we weren't any strange about us, but we both, the funny thing, I got so used to when I was in the car, I knew he was out, or when I was out, I knew he was driving. I had such a respect for his driving ability that I just knew the car was going to come back the way I'd left it, and it always did. And the same the other way around. And we just had an amazing rapport together. People would say, well, what did you ever say to him? I said, we never got time to talk, because one was getting in as the other got out, and that was it. Never spoke to him until 4 o'clock the next day.
Yeah.
But I just think it was I think we had a better rapport just with two drivers than when I had three.
Yeah, okay.
Because there's always it's that like three people away on a holiday for a weekend, or three guys go away, or, you know, you sort of had that relationship with two much better than you do with a third. There's always somebody, the third one, which is he or Mick over there, or, you know, and you become a little bit sort of, somebody could become isolated.
Yeah,
I would have thought.
Nick, you've won races as a major races as pairing and a three.
Yeah, I was going to just say that. Yeah, I think you're right in some way. It's you do you have I spent a long time with one one guy, Patrick, in racing in the States, and you kind of, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. When you're not in the car, he is. And you have a, I always said that I perform better because I didn't, I never wanted to let my teammate. My buddy down.
No, exactly.
You know,
because he becomes a buddy, not just a, to me, the extra driver was always a third driver. You know, even at, in the factory team, Al Holbert came, although I raced with him in one Daytona, three times with him, I got used to driving with him, but when he came to drive with Stuck and I, he was the third driver. He only he didn't do the whole championship with us, which is really what you're saying. So, you know, we had two drivers for the whole year and then three for that race. So somebody came in and he was always slightly the outsider. And I also don't think he got the best out of the third driver because I don't think he knew the car the way we did. He didn't know how we operated and how Porsche operated. So I think we had a special rapport because of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit different, I guess, this year because we do race full-time with the three drivers in in the WEC. Yeah. And, I mean, it's difficult to say because we haven't been together enough time, you know, 6 months or so, to really know if that's how it works out. Mm. But, yeah, it's difficult to say.
Do you think you guys would
When you win, it doesn't matter if it's two or three, when you win together, it's then you're a proper team.
Do you think you guys would have a rapport?
Well, I drove with him.
You get, I mean, you know each other well. You seem to have a good laugh.
We race them all.
Definitely,
you
guys.
Yeah, we'd have a good time. The whole point about it is, it's deadly serious, but you've got to have a sort of a sense of humour, which I think the British are pretty damn good at doing that. And I think you know we would get on very well together. We're all obviously in our time very quick. And that's all you need to be. And if you have a rapport together and respect the other driver, shit, that's great. You know, I'm driving with Richard, which I did. What did we do? Watkins Glen together.
Watkins Glen.
Yeah, 6 hours. And, you know, it was just great. I thought the relationship we had, and I think it would be the same with all of us. I think sometimes it's difficult when somebody comes that hasn't maybe raced for that team. Yeah. I mean for Porsche before, doesn't quite know the ropes. But then Porsche wouldn't do that to us. They always brought somebody in that had raced in a Porsche top car somewhere.
Sure. Okay. This interestingly, there's a couple of questions related to sports sciences. I think it's our readers are intrigued to know, from your perspective, Nick, you know, how important the sports science, the fitness, the rehydration side is now. And then from you guys early in your career, whether it was even on the table. One of our readers has asked, let's have a look. Griff Jones, 1 year at Le Mans, the Porsche doctors, dietitians had developed their own electrolyte energy drink to better hydrate the drivers, but apparently it's completely disgusting. This is
that's right. I think I know Griff Jones. If it's the Griff, I think it is. But yeah, I mean, he better go back where he was. But in the beginning, nobody could care a damn about anything. Yeah. It's up to you, to what you drank. I can remember just eating sandwiches during the race.
Yeah,
I really can't remember anything more than that, and it was always French baguette and ham and cheese. And you know, you never had anywhere to sleep if you fancied sleeping. I never ever slept the whole time I raced at Le Mans in all my years, but there wasn't anywhere to sleep anyway apart from the back of some greasy caravan if you were really lucky. But I think the drinking thing came in. Remember, I did it for 26 years, so eventually or gradually drink came in. And there was a particular guy from Chicago. I can see him now, but anyway, he produced a drink. And everybody in racing in America began to use it. And it wasn't a glucose drink, because everybody says, oh, you know, you should try drinking that. What's that sweet drink you have out there? Very popular thing that all the blokes have.
Gatorade.
Mm-hmm. And that's the worst thing you can have, because there's so much sugar in it, apparently, that when you drank it, it would actually take the fluids from your bloodstream to dilute it and bring it down to a more dilute, digestible drink.
Which cost you energy.
Yeah. So I never actually ever used it, but this guy produced this stuff and it wasn't that tasty to drink, particularly after 22 hours. You know, you needed something different. Yeah. And I must admit, I'll be very honest, in our period, we had a really good doctor, Dr. Huber, who came from the Mannheim Medical Institute of Sport or something. Charming man, but you can imagine the good of it. He turned up on a Friday night with a race the next day. So, get into my Kept Fit now. Oh, the race is in about 12 hours. So it was actually a waste of time, and you keep giving little capsules of this and capsules of that, and you know, you feel good and off you'd go.
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware. But it really didn't exist much. I think BMW were the first people to bring it in, and I remember that was during the early 70s. They used to have training stuff. I went on one because I raced for BMW 1 year, and we used to go to St. Moritz for our training sessions, and they were very intensive. I mean, they were horrible, but they were the first people I ever drove with that ever sort of bothered about our digestion.
And Richard, the 1970 race was famously one of the most boring.
Well, now there's a masseurs, dieticians, and doctors, and medics, and all sorts of things. We had nothing at all. It was down to the driver to sort themselves out as to what they had during the race and everything else. Nothing was laid out. Yeah. It was down to us. And I the only thing I used to do, my own personal training was just me. I didn't go to a personal trainer or anything like that. Now you would, of course. So I just ran around the block in green spot gym shoes, which probably didn't do my ankles much good. But it was self. You had to look after yourself. The more driving you did, then the easier it became, because then just the physical act of driving gives you, the muscles you need. Mm. And hydration, I was never very good at hydration when I was young, and somehow I didn't really need it. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's more important now, and I did suffer with kidney stones later in life, right, which of course is lack of hydration. But I got away with it when I was younger, and I finished when I was only 31.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to the stage where I need to look after myself better. So I suppose I did it in my younger years, and I was finished with it then, and it didn't matter anymore.
Yeah. So Nick, your turn for the contrast now.
But honestly, it's not. It's things you have access to these people.
Yeah.
And some drivers, they're religious about, I need to eat this, I need to drink this, I need to do this. But personally, I see it. I came into Porsche, or I came into professional racing when I was 26, 27, 28 years old.
Yeah.
So I'd already done 15 years of kind of privateer racing when I've known what my body needs and what I need to do way before I've got professional help.
Sure.
So
right.
For me personally, my body tells me when I'm hungry, I eat. If I fancy pasta, I'll eat pasta. If I fancy a chocolate pudding, I'll have a chocolate pudding in the middle of a race. Yeah. I try to limit the kind of keep it as simple as possible. Because if you need to drink these electrolyte stuff, and then it's not there, you're thinking, "Oh crap, where's my? I'm going to need this, otherwise I'm not going to be able to compete for 3 hours.
Yeah,
I need to get out in the car."
Yeah.
Where you just keep everything simple, and if your body needs to sleep, you can fall asleep. If you're hungry, you go and eat something.
I think he's so right that if you fancy eating one particular thing, you should eat it. And unfortunately, we got swung round that actually you must eat, that we were sort of advised to drink and eat what we were told to eat and drink. But I remember once at the Nürburgring in the Mirage, and I remember Nürburgring 1,000 Ks was 6 hours. It was bloody hard work. Mm. Two drivers around there, 33 laps in total. Doesn't sound much, but it was.
Yes.
And I remember it was time to get in again, and I saw this jug of milk, and I went, "Oh, great." And I grabbed it and drank it, and then went back in the car, and the seat had moved, or the leather had fallen out the seat because it was actually sitting on the chassis. My head was hitting the back, and I ended up throwing up, which, of course, you can imagine. Coagulated milk in a Bell helmet isn't very pretty. Anyway, but that was it. And ever after that, I was very rigid about what I drank during the race, whereas before it didn't seem to bother me.
Yeah. And now a message from Mercedes-Benz, who are our partners in these podcasts. If you're looking for a special birthday gift, the Drive and Dine package from Mercedes-Benz is perfect for any car fan. Not only do you get an hour's AMG driving experience and a free passenger ride, you'll also enjoy a two-course lunch for two in the Gullwing Bistro. It costs £245 per person. Simply quote Drive and Dine when you call 0370 400 4000 to book. Booking is open now and terms apply. The number again is 0370 400 4000. You mentioned the Nürburgring. One question, it's a very simple one. Best circuit to race on, and if you could go back and race at that circuit, which car
Well, start that then, because I keep answering the first one. I'm still in the light.
It's a Mini 850.
Well, yeah. It's probably the most fun racing we've ever done.
Graham Harris has asked this question. One car, one race, one circuit.
All right, how about Bristol Motor Speedway in a NASCAR truck?
Because you've not done it.
Because I've not done it, and I'd love to have a go.
Yeah.
And it's oval racing, which is where my background is. So. Yeah. But yeah. Favourite track is Nürburgring North Loop. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Richard.
My favourite track in period was a track called Clermont-Ferrand. Mm. And that was a circuit built around a mountain. It was 5 miles long. It combined bits of everything, Monte Carlo, Nürburgring, Spa, and but hugely dangerous. Mm-hmm. There was a downhill straight, and you'd go far faster than the car could go and more. And at the bottom of that, you've got a hairpin right. And if something didn't work going down there, you were just going to die. Mm-hmm. And but it had so many fast sweeps up a hill and down. The topography was good too. Mm. That was my favourite circuit, and it was in a single seater, so it would have to be in a single seater. And the car that I drove then was a Lola. Mm. But yes, I would have liked to have had something a bit better than a Lola. But other than that, a small engine capacity car where you've got to be neat and tidy.
Yeah,
that would have been my choice. But I wouldn't do it now because it's too dangerous.
Too dangerous, yeah. And was it the rhythm that made it good? Made it so exciting?
Just there were so many different corners that you know it's 5 miles long, and it didn't, because of certain you sectionize certain parts of the circuit off, and then it starts to get easier, you know. Mm. And there were a lot of really fast uphill turns, and they were nearly flat, but not quite, you know. And it really tests you. Big brows to go over, and then really tight corners. It combined everything. Fabulous circuit, fabulous track. It's not. It's only half there, I think, now.
Yeah, sure.
I haven't been back ever since, and I loved it so much. So I got the fastest race lap. I don't think I ever won there, but I loved the circuit. I really did.
Well, believe it or not, they're having a celebration there next year. Of certain number of years since it opened or closed, one or the other.
Yeah, okay.
I met the guy the other day at an event somewhere in Europe, and he said, "Would you like to come?" Because I raced there. Mm. In fact, in my very first Formula One race for Techno, which wasn't my first Formula One race, but should have been for Brabham, but ultimately it was a Techno, and we went all the way to bloody Clermont-Ferrand for the French Grand Prix. Went out and did practice, and every session I went out in the car went slower, but I kept changing it, and I kept changing it to get it around the corners. Couldn't figure it out. Arrived on race morning, and David York, he put the team together, who used to run the Gulf Porsches, and he'd put this program together for Martini, because it came from the sports car program. And as I walked in, David was standing with his legs sort of astride the car, and he said, "I'm sorry, old son, you're not driving it." I said, "Oh, God, can you imagine? After a year and a half of waiting for the car, it wasn't ready." And I went, "I don't believe that, David." He said, "Look here, old son." And there were 9 bolts that held the engine. They tried to do a Cosworth-type situation to bolt the engine to the rear wheels. And in fact, 4 of them had broken. That's why every time I went out the car, it actually got worse in the corners. It was gradually pinging off bolts that held it together. So, but it was a heck of a racetrack. No, I think the Nürburgring, as he rightly says, and maybe Spa. Certainly, I loved the old Spa, but it was bloody dangerous. But there was something electric about that place. And I think Elkhart Lake in America is pretty special.
Yes.
I always seem to like longer circuits than short Mickey Mouse things with 7 corners. I like 17 corners if possible.
Yeah. Minimum 17.
Yeah, something like that, yes.
And the car. Need the car as well.
Oh, yes, the
car. Sorry?
Need the car.
So one car, if you could have... One lap, one
such
car.
So difficult to say. I really difficult. Mm. But I would say one of the best cars I ever drove was a Ferrari 333 SP, when I only drove it at Daytona and Sebring. But it was so bloody fast, that basically a Formula One monocoque with a 3-liter, flat 12 engine in the back. It was absolutely, you get out grinning from ear to ear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There was no technical bugs on it. It was actually a real race car.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I remember you raving about that car, because it was a really, for that short era, it was a really up-to-speed car,
wasn't
it?
That's right, 1998.
Yeah, really on it, yeah.
Okay, this is a question from Roy Beddoe. Thanks for the question, Roy. It's specifically aimed at you, Nick, but I think you guys as well, would be some great insight from you as well. So for motorsport and Porsche fans in particular, your 2015 performances were sensational. I guess you know this person, right?
Talking about your wife.
To name just two of them, your stint through the night at Le Mans and the overall win in the rain at Road Atlanta in a GT car.
I agree.
Belong in the pantheon of great drives by any measure. Mm-hmm. Behind the wheel, did you feel something special at the time? Some sort of rare oneness with the machine or an out-of-body experience even?
No, but
it's sorry,
just
Ryan.
Kind of what we do. And if you're lucky, you get a good car at good conditions at a good time. And people asked that we had a great year in 2015.
Yeah.
We won all sorts of things based around Le Mans, and we won championships in WEC and IMSA, and all these big races. And and people said, did you drive better that year, or you know, have you been in? I said, I just managed to find myself in the right place and the right car at the right time. Yeah. Mm. And I was, you know, it was all part of that. I think one thing that did stand out at Le Mans that year, it was obviously the second race that the three of us had done in the car. So we did a fair bit of testing pre-season, and we raced at Spa as a warm-up. But kind of the first time that I really felt on top of the car and that I was absolutely 100% in control of everything that was happening with it was during the race. And I think that probably showed a bit, the fact that we were so competitive at that time and at that point of our development of the three driver crew of that car that came on so strong in that race and then obviously went and won. But we drive so much and we've done it for so many years that it becomes that's my comfort zone, and that's my relaxation zone is when I'm in a car and it, you know, you're driving flat out. That's normal. Mm. And it's not a out of body experience, it's a complete inner body experience, because that's just what I do. And I guess it's the same for all of us. It's when you're on top of the world and you're doing these sorts of things, that's what we do. That's
I think that really, if I may interrupt before you speak, and your mouth was still closed, so nothing was coming out.
I was having a little nod.
I thought you were. but I watched Nick's race at Atlanta. For Le Mans thing I was watching too, but you don't really watch Le Mans. It's too bloody long to watch. But especially when you've done it that many times.
About 12 o'clock at night anyway.
But that Road Atlanta race I thought was fantastic that you did. And I couldn't quite believe it. And it's strange, we're talking a little bit about it earlier, not how wonderful he was, but the fact that how much we enjoyed that sort of racing in America. And I had several races, because I raced there a hell of a lot in sort of the IMSA series in the Lernbrau Porsche, you know, running 750, 800 horsepower and those things. And the tracks were so conducive to just actually attacking them so hard. And a number of times that I remember, we were in a race, and if we actually could knock another 3/4 of a second off our lap time, we had a chance to win, and you'd go through. And although you're driving at 100%, sometimes you actually run at 105 or 101 or 110%. But you're actually in your comfort zone. You think, yeah, but I was quicker before. Why aren't I doing that now? That was when I was flat out. So what am I doing now going that much quicker? Because there's a carrot up there, and it's calling you through. His was the victory, which was massive, and also his particular one, Atlanta. Because the fact is, he wasn't leading all the time. I mean, he pulled himself through from positions as we had done as well over the years. And I remember thinking, I wish I had another race like that, because somehow those sort of races brought more out of you than you ever imagined.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know what, and I don't think everybody can do that, but I certainly know certain people can just sort of bring that extra bit out when they had to.
Yeah.
And you can't say why. Why do the cars suddenly go quicker?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, but you just managed to find something because you felt so at ease with it.
Yeah. Is there a moment that you think?
I think you get totally consumed in what they're doing. The car has to be really good. And you do get out of it probably more that was certainly more than you thought was possible. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to believe that anybody else, actually, whoever it might be, could get as much out of that as well. Yeah. And it's, I suppose, it's almost a self-belief as well, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But you have no time to think about anything else. You're totally absorbed to a degree that might almost seem dangerous in a way, but you're not in danger. Mm. You're not. You're on top and above everything. Mm. You're right on it, and you're right on top of it, and you feel it. It could lead to something that, you know, might be very unfortunate, where your self-belief actually is beyond expectation.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about, what we have been talking about, you haven't gone that far, and yet you're still blindingly fast.
Yeah. Interesting. Going back to your point, Derek, I remember a long time ago I interviewed you, and you told me that every now and again you'd have a word with the car before.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Is this how you got the extra 5%? I don't know why that stuck in my mind.
Yeah, no, it's right. Yeah, it's weird. I mean, you don't talk to a car. You're such a twerp, but there's nobody else to talk to, so I may as well talk to the car. But, you know, I mean, you're in it, and, you know, it's sort of, I remember the 935, you'd get in it and get hold of the gear lever and say, right, I mean, this thing had, 700 odd horsepower, that bloody... And you get hold of it and you'd start it up like that, you know, and you get hold of the gear lever, this bloody great thing sticking up level with your shoulder, you say, right, it's either you or me today, but it's me. And you get it in the first gear and off you go, and everything was a major, it wasn't none of this finger stuff, it was like, whoa, you know, up and down the box and, you know, coming in a corner. I mean, it was magic, it was amazing to sort of attack it, but it's rather like we're all saying you had to get into a rhythm whereby it wasn't normal, actually, to drive that sort of car.
Yeah.
But you had to get into this outer world, really, just to experience it and get hold of it.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about your cars now. The three of you are here today because you have a car each, effectively, that's been crafted around signature aspects, I guess, of your successes. So can I hear it from your own words? Tell us about the three cars that have been created by Porsche. Who's going to start? Richard, you start. You tell me about your 911.
Well, I think they're all the same.
They're all the same.
Yeah. They are, but we did, we chose the specifications. I think we pretty much, because we're racers, we think in a similar vein, I suppose. And they're not necessarily the cars we would order for ourselves, but as at the time, and even now, we weren't going to have to pay for anything. You know, we'll have that.
Yep.
And limited slip discs, which is, I think, quite unusual, really. But it was personalising everything you could possibly want without, you know, silly stuff that you don't really need. But it was all poor performance related.
Yeah.
We all chose four-wheel drive, which sounds silly, really, when it should be a sports car. You know, you hear people and Top Gear guys hanging the tail out and all that sort of thing. But we want to be swift and safe.
Yeah.
And sure, really. And four-wheel drive does have advantages over two-wheel drive.
Yeah.
Particularly when you get up into the horsepower stakes, and these cars are quite quick.
3.6 seconds, 0-60.
Well, that, yeah.
They're something quick, else, isn't it?
and there's no loss, or dry takeoff. And they're 450 horsepower, whatever they are. And, for what we want to drive on the road, that's what we would want.
Yep. So we have the Porsche Salzburg red and white livery for your car,
yeah,
Richard.
Yeah.
We have the sapphire blue metallic, which you've very kindly colour-coded for us today in the
very nice to
in the podcast. And Nick, tell us about yours.
Yes, it's white, just like the 919 that we won with.
Yeah.
Adorned with, you know, special graphics on the side, a road car bearing all of our signatures.
That's good, mate. That's a good feeling, is it?
It's unbelievable. The fact that Porsche are going to go and produce these vehicles on their production line, based around what we've kind of sat around a table and said, yeah, we'd like to do this and we'd like to do that and we want a bit of this and we want, and then they turn around and say, no, you can't have that and you can't have this. But, there's certain aspects, like we all
we're all racers, so things like the suspension systems, the rear steer, things like this, it's all standard kit. You know, it's an option on most cars, but it's just standard because we're going to have it.
Yeah.
All the performance stuff.
Yeah.
Things like the PDK gearbox, the fastest shifting gearbox that you can have from Porsche. So that's in the car. Yeah. Manual obviously is an option for people that want to do this, but. And you know, other special stuff like the Alcantara that we have all over the race car. That was something that I wanted to put in. It's in the Le Mans car for a reason.
Mm.
So you know, for light dissipation reasons and touch surfaces. So why not have more of it in my road car?
We told Sandra and Hülkenberg.
I've sent him some sneaky pictures. Yeah, Earl was very jealous, actually.
That's really awkward.
But they look great, you know, don't they?
They do.
You know, a red, white, and a blue car, British Racing Legends edition.
Yeah, it's lovely. Career, we're very lucky. GTS, I mean,
crikey.
I keep saying it, for his, you know, he's being such a young guy, he could have two or three more before the end of his career. We're sort of at the tatty edge of our life, and. You know, we get the honour then, and nobody else has really done it anywhere before that I'm aware of. I mean, they might have done one for a particular driver, but for us to have them with our names on is pretty special, and is sort of a great accolade after all the years we've done and all of us have put through into it.
Do you still have your 924?
Carrera GT, I do, yes. Very much so. Actually, a gentleman came up this afternoon to discuss it, because he saw it, and he said, what's that doing in our dealership at the moment down at Bournemouth? So. Yeah, I still do. I mean, it's 36 years old. It's amazing, isn't it? And it still goes like the wind. Actually, not today it doesn't, but it was when I took it to the garage. But no, it's super, yeah.
I'm afraid we have to wrap up. Really, really pleased to see you guys together. I mean, it's been a fantastic day, and I'm sure we could talk for many, many hours. I'd love to be able to get you guys back on a Motorsport Magazine podcast, so let's see if the planets will align to make that happen. But thanks very much for joining us, and thank you very much for listening.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best? Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.